I'm sorry, so sorry, you're staying, I'm leaving. Sitting in the airport, waiting for the plane to come. After bringing me out, you're making your way back home. And it's always a drag when you're on your own.
CITR 101.9 FM Radio, broadcasting from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia, Vancouver, Canada. This is the Wednesday, April 24, 2013 edition of Smart People, a weekly half-hour show featuring interviews with smart people. I am your host, Elmer Weens.
Today I'm talking with David Trek, talking to him on the phone, a very smart and intelligent person. How are you doing, David? Hello? I don't seem to have David on the phone. Okay, what? Yeah, just to give you a bit of background, David has a PhD in economics from UBC, has been a Hello, David, are you there now?
Yes, I am.
Oh, great. this is student radio. I mentioned to you, you might have a little bit of a problem. Okay, so I'm talking on the phone with a very smart, intelligent person, David Trek. David has a PhD in economics from UBC, has been a candidate for political office a number of times, and has some interesting experiences in the health insurance sector and much, much more, some of which listeners can find on David Trek's website, strategicthoughts.com. Okay, again, welcome, David. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Great, and welcome to Student Radio. We're going to have a lot of fun here in the next half hour. David, you were probably best known as the NDP candidate for North Vancouver Lonsdale from 1991 to 1996, during which you were the parliamentary secretary to the premier.
Well, a little simple math will tell you that 1996 was 17 years ago. So, it's arguable whether I am best known for that phase of my life. There have been many phases. In the 70s, I was chief executive officer of Vancouver Resources Board, responsible for all of the social services in the city of Vancouver. In the 80s, I managed a between first and second largest dental insurer in the province. In the 90s, I was involved in politics, first as an MLA and then working as a staffer in the premier's office. And for the last 10 or more years, I've been basically retired, but enjoying myself almost full-time as a political pundit.
Yes, you're on CKNW and on one of the radio stations in Victoria. Which one is that?
From time to another, the only regular show is on CKNW, usually after the 4 o'clock news on Sunday. From time to time, I'm asked to do an interview on CFAX in Victoria. Yesterday, I was on a political panel on CBC on the coast. So there are a variety of things that come up sporadically. The regular gig is CKNW. All of this, by the way, is free. I do it as my hobby.
Oh, I see. Yeah, we were just talking about that before the show. We were pretty happy that you agreed to appear on this student radio show. I knew when we were graduate students at UBC in economics, and that goes back even farther. David, I hope you enjoyed this little musical introduction. I don't know if you heard it. It was the band Chilliwack playing their 1980 hit song Communication Breakdown from their 2003 album There and Back. The reason why I played that is the HST has dominated the BC political scene since the last provincial election. And it seemed to me that the liberals tried to cast their failure with the HST as bad communication. In your opinion, did the people of BC vote against the HST because of a communication breakdown?
Well, I've learned in politics that there are about as many reasons for people voting as there are people. I think apologists for the HST like to say that the reason it lost in the referendum and there was the massive political backlash was a communication issue. And there's a great deal of truth in that, particularly when you compare how the HST was introduced in Ontario almost concurrently and in the Maritimes. And in both cases, there was some active political discussion and pushback, but nothing like what we saw in British Columbia. And the reason we had that backlash in British Columbia is the Gordon Campbell went into the election giving no indication at all that the HST would be introduced, and I believe it was just 6 weeks after the election, said, surprise, surprise, we're going to have the HST. Mm-hmm. You just cannot spring that big of a surprise on people.
No, even Gordon Campbell couldn't do it. And, of course, that brought Mr. Van der Zalm into the scene and a large group formed opposing the HST.
Now, I think there's a lot more to it than communication. As is the case with many political issues, many economic issues, there are as many different sides to the question. I used to get together with Jack Webster for a cup of coffee from time to time back in the day in the 70s when I was managing the resource board, the late Jack Webster.
Yes.
And Jack would always say there are at least 27 sides to every story, and so it is with the HST. There are theoretical arguments in favor of a value-added tax. Problem is how you get from here to there.
Well, that is a tax on the consumer. The HST is a tax on the consumer, and
as is the PST. And the question is the base going to be covering virtually everything, goods and services, or will it be a tax just on goods, as the PST tends to be? And the problem is when you move from the one to the other, is it really involves a tax shift. In this case, somewhere between $1.5 and $2 billion per year from business to consumers. Now, those who think that was a good idea argue that the price system ultimately makes this all work out.
Yeah.
Now, that may be theoretically true in a closed economy,
yeah.
And even then, everybody isn't equally a winner and loser. But in a big world, small economy, open trader, it's not true at all.
Well,
because you get a lot of leakages through exports.
The NDP campaigned against the HST, and the right-wing Fraser Institute campaigned in favor of the HST. Is this just a left-right political issue?
No, not at all. I think, and one of the reasons the Liberals are in trouble in the current election campaign is this split across party lines. I have friends who were very upset that the NDP and I and Bill Thielman and Bill Van der Zalm were out there doing everything we could to kill the HST, because their attitude was any tax is a good tax, it helps you fund more public services. Their argument may have been a little more sophisticated than that. I don't want to do them a complete injustice, but the point is that there were people on the left who favored the HST, and there were people on the right, political right, who thought it was absolutely atrocious. And one of the reasons the Liberals are in trouble is a large portion of their political base felt it was unacceptable.
Right.
And they still haven't forgiven them.
No, that's right. I know I ran as a Liberal way back in 1991 in Victoria Hillside, and I thought of myself as a Liberal for quite a while, but I was very unhappy with the way the HST was introduced, and I didn't really believe the models that some of the economists came out in favor of the HST.
Well, I think it was completely unfair to the public to say that all economists are of one mind on an issue like this. As you know, if you line up 100 economists, you'll get 105 different opinions.
Right. Well, let's just move on a bit. As economists, you and I, you know, we're interested in government expenditures and the government debt. The BC Liberals under Gordon Campbell outspent the NDP in comparable 10-year intervals, as I found out in the newspaper, Vancouver Sun. The NDP budgets grew by about 2.5% per year in real terms from 1991 to 2001. 2.5%, while the BC Liberal budgets grew by about 4.1% from 2001 to 2011. How do you account for, you know, this reversal in the usual paradigm of who outspends whom?
Well, in fairness, Mike Dion, Minister of Finance, wrote a rebuttal to that, which was published as a letter to the editor. And once again, as you know, it is quite common in economics to argue about methodology and data. And when it comes to comparing government expenditures from year to year, it is very challenging to get accurate data that you can compare over any length of time. The reason for that is the government spending is constantly being restructured. You can go to the public accounts and get the numbers for any given year after the fact, the audited financial statement, and in those public accounts you can get the restated comparable numbers for the previous year. But you can't string those together in a 20 or 30-year time string, because over that period of time, they change the basis of accounting so as to include the so-called such sector, mm-hmm. Universities, colleges, hospitals, and the like, which is a major conceptual change. They also move components of government from one ministry to the other, and they offload and take some things off book, as they did with the Transportation Authority running the Portman Bridge, or like they did with BC Ferries. So when you look at data over a time period, it's hard to compare, and it's basically simply accurate to say spending went up both under the NDP and under the Liberals. It's arguable under which government it went up the most, but it is not black and white, and it is pure political BS for one side or the other to try to claim the high ground.
Yeah. Before we go to a station break, let's continue on this with the debt situation. The Gordon Campbell Liberals increased the BC government's debt from $35 billion to $45 billion. And Christy Clark's Liberals have increased this debt to $56 billion. That's $11 billion over the last 3 years. What's going on here? And can the NDP, do you think the NDP could keep the debt under control?
Well, whoever is government has to keep the debt under control in the sense of the debt measured relative to the gross national product. That's the key indicator that the bond rating agencies look at. No one in their right mind believes this nonsense that's being spread out there that the BC debt is going to disappear. As you pointed out, the debt is now almost $60 billion. It's slated to go to $70 billion at the end of this next three-year period. On top of that, the footnotes to the public account show $96 billion in contractual obligations, which many would argue are almost equivalent to a debt. You can't get out of those contractual obligations without buying your way out. And those contractual obligations weren't reported in the financial statements until 2005. They first appeared in 2005 in a footnote showing $25 billion worth. Mm-hmm. So just between 2005 and 2013, contractual obligations increased from $25 billion to $96 billion, probably higher than $96 billion as a 2011 figure. At the same time, the debt was doubling every 10 years. Mm-hmm. So the bond rating agencies will be concerned about that sort of thing, and the rate of growth of debt must not exceed the rate of growth of GDP or there will be credit downgrades and higher interest will have to be paid.
Right.
The liberals cannot claim the high ground on this. The rate of increase of the debt and contractual obligations was much higher under the Liberal government than it was under the NDP government. Both have had problems, and the current claims that the debt will disappear because of LNG, or they are just absolute pure nonsense. There's a scathing editorial in the Financial Post today just questioning why Christy Clark would make statements with respect to the debt and the deficit and the whether or not the budget is balanced when anybody knows that those statements are not true.
Yeah, okay. Thanks, David. I got to take a two-minute station break. I'm talking to David Schreck. This is the show Smart People. I'm the host, Elmer Weins. We're going to talk a bit more about the debt when we get back in about 2 minutes. Don't go away, David. I hope I don't lose you in the interim. I don't think I will, but here we go.
Okay.
CITR 101.9 FM radio, broadcasting from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia, Vancouver, Canada.
I feel like I'm losing my mind. Now I know what I'm leaving behind. When I get down, I ought to write you a letter. I'm on the run, but I can't run forever. Touch me, baby, I'm all right. But it's not the same when you're out of sight. With what I know, I ought to do much better. A little note will bring me to you.
CITR 101.9 FM radio, broadcasting from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia, Vancouver, Canada.
And I'm back here with David Trek. This is the show Smart People. I'm the host, Elmer Weins. And I'm talking with David Schreck, who is a both smart person and intelligent. He must be intelligent because he has a PhD. Hi, dude. We're back.
I think that's more of an endurance test than an IQ test, Elmer.
We both have PhDs.
Yeah, that's right.
And we're still around anyway. We were talking about the debt picture, and I was really amazed this morning when I heard that the NDP is thinking of privatizing BC Place and the Vancouver Convention Center. Now, I think that's quite a good idea. What do you think?
Well, what the NDP announced is that within the first 90 days of it taking office, should the voters decide to give it a majority government, it would appoint an independent panel to review the options on whether either the stadium, BC Place, or the convention center, or both, should be sold. We don't know whether there'd be a market for selling those assets. And an independent panel would look at whether that is feasible. What we know right now is that they are both losing money, and the projection for the next 5 years is a further loss of, I think it's something like $70 or $80 million. So this is troublesome. And by pointing out that the NDP would look at privatizing those assets. It both breaks through this sort of right-left nonsense. Any government will assess the value of hanging on to a particular asset and whether to liquidate it or not. And it cuts through this business of, do you book the value of selling the asset before or after you sell it? The Liberal government is claiming a balanced budget based on sticking a number in for assets of which it will not provide a list, being sold at values yet to be determined, and yet they are booking the money as if it's money in the bank. The NDP is saying, well, we will evaluate selling these two assets that are currently losing money. It wouldn't be booked until a decision to sell is made and the money is received.
Yeah,
it's a very fascinating discussion point for looking at differences mm-hmm. between parties.
It'd be pretty cool if they could recoup the construction costs, which were pretty staggering. We want to move on. I still got quite a few items I want to talk
okay.
to with David about. We're talking about the political scene, talking with David Schreck. And there's other parties in B.C. There's a B.C. Green Party running, almost, I think, a full slate of candidates. There's the Conservative Party, which both parties have about 10 to 13% popularity in the latest polls. And they're running, and three independent candidates are running, John Van Dogen, Dogan in Abbotsford South, Bob Simpson in Caribou North, and Vicky Huntington, all are named candidates running as independents. But getting back with David Schreck, I found it interesting that you campaigned on the no side in the referendum to change how MLAs are elected. What was that about, quickly, because we're...
Well, I support the idea of some type of proportional representation in theory, but the devil's always in the details. And the STV system in particular was outrageously troublesome. It would have implemented a system of multiple MLAs, up to five or six MLAs covering a particular area, with a voting system that was so complicated you couldn't explain to anyone how it worked.
Yeah.
And we on the no side actually ran focus groups and showed the pro-STV video on how to count the ballots
yeah.
and discovered that when you showed people who were in support of the change how the votes were counted, using the video from the people supporting the change, they changed their mind and didn't want to have anything to do with it.
Right. And, here at UBC... a lot of students are just finishing off writing their exams and they're heading home to their home writings. What can students do to get involved in the election campaign?
Well, the most important thing is to register to vote and actually vote.
Yeah,
it is a shockingly low voter turnout for younger people.
All parties, I believe, want more people to vote, and then they fight over who gets their share.
Well, people under 30 have more reason to vote than elder people do, because people under 30 are going to be living some of the consequences that the governments that get elected will foist upon them, whereas us old guys might not be around that long,
yeah.
And yet it's the young people who tend not to show up to vote. The best thing to do is to make sure you're registered to vote, turn out to vote, and in preparing to vote, do everything possible to read everything you can on all of the different party platforms and statements in the news media. And don't believe any of it. Use what's between your ears to fact check on everything you see, because there will be mistakes in the news media, there will be politicians that intentionally mislead, there will be partial information. Participating in a democracy is hard work. But the alternative is to let your neighbor make all of the decisions for you.
Yes, good point, David. But you did mention us old guys. A lot of the baby boomers are retiring. Who speaks for us? I was looking at the paper in the last couple of days, and I see that BC's corporations are pouring in like a staggering amount of money into the BC Liberal Party, some like $46 million. And the unions, of course, have to match that to a certain extent, and they're putting quite a bit of money into the NDP party, looking out for their members' interests, as do the corporations are looking after their bottom line. So who's speaking for us old guys?
Well, ultimately the unions and the corporations don't vote. Individual voters do. So we have to put the pressure on to have the politicians speak for us, because they want our votes, even though they may want the money from the other folks. But the NDP, the Greens, and the Conservatives are all saying that they would eliminate corporate and union donations to political parties, just as is the law in Quebec, Manitoba, and federally.
Hmm.
The Liberal Party is the only party saying that it would continue to allow corporate and union donations. It's time for fundamental election reform, election finance reform. Union and corporate donations should be banned.
Yeah. An issue which isn't exactly a BC one, just some quick points now, like the RBC outsourcing of jobs. What do you think of that? That's pretty...
Well, it was certainly a public relations black eye for RBC to be outsourcing its IT department. RBC's response is, well, they employ 35,000 people in Canada, and this was a small outsourcing. But I don't think many Canadians would like to have their personal information, their personal banking information, handled by outsourced contractors in India.
Yeah. UBC is planning to bring in a batch of international students at about $30,000 per year tuition, about 1,000 students in the first year. It will reach 1,000 students, and then I guess over 4 years, that'll be another 4,000 students. I did a bit of math, and with the existing 4,000 international students at UBC in the undergraduate program, that's going to be like 25% of the students at UBC are international students. Is this like outsourcing students?
Well, you can compare it to exporting coal. The economics of it, selling education services by having international students come here, have the same effect on the balance of payments accounts as selling coal does.
Yeah, but
and it's a cleaner transaction. It also has the side benefit of having Canadian students rub shoulders with international students.
Well, they're doing that already.
Broaden everyone's horizons.
Well, they're doing that already. But what about the BC students? I mean, you practically have to have an A average now to get into UBC.
That's always the problem. And the argument is, do the international students squeeze out and take the seats that Canadians would otherwise take?
Yeah.
Those who support having the international students usually argue that they are a profit center, and that the money made off of charging international students outrageous tuition fees helps to fund seats for Canadian students. As is the case in many such debates, it's always hard to tell exactly where the truth lies.
Yeah, but there's not which students can pay